Oh, Kieran's on holiday season, Caroline. Okay, so do you want me to mention that? Okay, no problem. Business Matters, Kieran is on holidays. For this week's Business Matters, though, we delve into his box and we go back to an interview in January when Kieran spoke to the co-owner of Donegal Bees in Glencolum Kill, Thomas Ellis. A former carpenter, Thomas set up the company in 2013 and in 2020, Anya Corran became a co-owner. Donegal Bees has the only wax processing facility in Ireland and a product range of almost 900. Donegal Bees won the Green Award at the 2022 Donegal Enterprise Awards hosted by the Donegal Local Enterprise Office. So if you want to hear that conversation, revisit that conversation between Kieran and Thomas Ellis, go onto our website. It's live for you right now, highlandradio.com, or indeed, you can download it and listen to it at your leisure, as they say in the United States. A caller says, we also had a coroner court and the driver of the vehicle did not show up and the coroner said he couldn't compel them to appear. How is that fair? We feel the coroner's court should have more strength. If this person caused the incident, they should be made sit and listen to the consequences of their actions, which is a very interesting point, all right. Charlie McConnellogue has let fisheries, farmers and MICA homeowners down. We want Martin McDermott to run for TD. He represents all homeowners of Inishowen. Well, could he be persuaded to switch ranks to 100% redress party? I don't know. Right. Chairperson. So this is just a readout from Frank, is it, Caroline? Is Caroline? Neve? Is this just a readout as it relates to Frank O'Donnell? No. I'll come back to that, Caroline. This just, I read this out from Frank O'Donnell, yeah? Or is, okay. So Frank O'Donnell, chairperson, the Michael Collins, Dr. McGinley branch of Fine Gael in Donegal called to say, Joe McHugh is no longer in the party and no longer attends meetings. But we have Councillor Jimmy Kavanagh, who's very active representative on the ground, and we're very proactive in the Letterkenny Milford area. I'd like this acknowledged. Yes, indeed. And the Councillor Jimmy Kavanagh is, of course, as you mentioned, but we could only really speculate because we know Joe McHugh's situation and what he has said in terms of whether or not the likes of a councillor, Jimmy Kavanagh, and in fact, if he wants to launch his general election campaign right now, I would be more than happy to speak to him. We can't really speculate as to what, you know, certain people might want to do or not do, but Councillor Jimmy Kavanagh, if he's going at it, let us know, and I'd love to have a chat with him, which we talk to Jimmy regularly on the show. Greg, well done, Kathy and Brendan. Know both of them for years. What a great initiative, and congrats on your 10 years of giving back. Great service indeed. Wonderful idea about naming the new bike after we know it, etc. Wishing all continued success. That comes in from Mary. A caller says, if you run, jog, walk the roads, you'll see how dangerous overgrown hedges are. Yes, indeed. There's no doubt about that. But if you're referring to what I was saying, I just noticed that some hedges have been quite extensively cut. In my opinion, constituency revisions are usually drawn to suit certain political parties. Let's not be so naive, perhaps a form of gerrymandering. I'm sure there are those that woke up to that news this morning who may be of that mind. Another, I'd love to see Piers Thomas and Kira elected in South Donegal and Porrig Merity and the anti-MICA candidate in the north of the constituency. I'd love to see Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil get their due rewards at the next election. The sooner these Tory parties go, the better. They would say that that's not who they are or what they stand for. Buncrana Town Council are wasting money hand over fist with their antics. How does Cara and Donagh keep their town so well and no parking charges? Buncrana Town Council should be ashamed for asking for the half-hour free parking to be abolished. What good is a town with no shops or customers? Can Nicholas Crossan explain this to us on your show? Well, there's no such thing as Buncrana Town Council anymore. I think what you meant was Buncrana Town Councillor. I think Nicholas Crossan was saying we need to discuss all the options and all the ramifications. I'm not sure he was straight up advocating for it to be scrapped. But anyway, listen, keep those calls and comments coming in. Well, with summer holidays drawing to an end and having already drawn to an end for some, many children might feel anxious about going back to school. So on Wellness Wednesday this week, we talked to mental health expert Noel McDermott on how to spot signs of the back to school blues and ways to help prepare your child in advance for starting a new school year. Noel McDermott, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. It's good to be back, actually.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. So I suppose, I mean, we have to understand our children, talk to our children so we can understand what is nerves, what's acting up a little bit to try and avoid going, and what is genuinely, you know, a state that they're in.
Well, kids are difficult to diagnose from a clinical perspective because they will downplay those things that mean you'll stop them having fun and play up those things that they dislike. So there's always that to factor into. But in general, you know your kids well. And if their behaviour is out of sorts, you will spot it. And the warning signs are sort of interruptions, things like sleep patterns or appetite patterns or general outlook on life, which may happen during any transition. And if we think about the move from summer holidays to school, it's just a big transition that you've got to go through. And any one of us going through a big transition may be upset by it. And we need to sort of generalize it in that context. So it's not about going back to school. It's about there's a big change taking place, and big changes that take place generally upset us as human animals because we like things steady and stable as you go along.
How important is it that we strap on our big boy pants and we don't allow ourselves to sort of be over triggered by someone who's a bit peed off having to go back to school? You know, they're a bit grumpy, they're talking back a bit, you know what I mean?
It's also partly about trying to do broader lessons for your kids, right? So it's a known issue, and so we don't need to panic is what I'm saying. Yeah. And it's understandable if your kids have some psychological distress and emotional distress about these big changes. It's really important not to say or reinforce this notion it's about going back to school, because actually there might be some good things about going back to school, like they don't have to put up with you. So it's like there's some advantages for your kids. And they're going to be seeing their mates and probably doing some activities that they really enjoy as well at school with their friends and arranging other social activities. So it's not all bad news. So that's all I'm saying about that thing, really. Yeah. Is.
So what should we be doing? How should we be talking about it? And I suppose it's all age dependent. Some are going into baby infants or first class. Some are going into secondary. Some are going to college.
Yeah, absolutely. But as human animals, we all pretty much need the same things to help us through times like this. And so what I would suggest is, and you can do this both pre and post the actual change, is you look at things like routine and structure. So get that routine and structure in as soon as you can, or maintain it after they've gone back to school. So going to bed at a reasonable time, getting up at a reasonable time. Those early morning routines, you know, even if you're still off school at the moment, there's no harm in getting your kids up, making them do all the teeth brushing, showering, put their clothes on, and then they can watch TV. You know, you can do it that way, and then it's not so much of a shock when they're actually putting the school uniform on next week or the week after or whenever it is. So you start those routines. Think about, because it is upsetting, it genuinely is, these life transitions. Like, think about if you move house or if you get a new job or something like that. It might be a good thing, but you're still going to be, you know, discombobulated by it. So think about with your kids and with yourselves having some extra treats on. So things that you know you like doing, whether that's popcorn and Netflix at home or whatever it is. And then also think about things that can help, that we know help in general health and well-being, like using the local park more, going out for events, doing group events, doing group activities, any sort of group activities, because all these produce sort of hormonal responses in us that are positive hormonal responses that will counteract the stress hormones that we're getting from the transition. So it's that type of stuff, that combination of normalizing through understanding it, through putting in routines and that support and structures, and through sort of, if you like, medication, through nice stuff and good group activities.
And, you know, when you talk of psychological education, it's a fancy name for just talking things through, really, and helping them to understand that what they're feeling is normal. You know what I mean? Like, it's basic stuff, but sometimes it's the basic things we, as parents and guardians, I think, especially in a busy world, we kind of forgo sometimes.
Yeah, it's also, I mean, I think there's psychology, old psychology has some blame here, because it tends to what we call pathologize, turn everything into a problem, and it's not. So the example I like to give is, you know, I'm getting over jet lag at the moment, and I took my son off to America and we're back. And I feel rough, but I'm supposed to feel rough because I've got jet lag. That's the way it is. I know that I'm going to feel rough. And I was able to talk to him about it and say, yeah, you can't sleep because of jet lag and you feel rubbish because you can't sleep, et cetera, et cetera. You'll get over it. So with that knowledge, you can then go, well, this is expected and it's not necessarily a problem. Where it becomes a problem is when you know it's an expected response, but it goes on a bit too long. And this is the warning I'd give to parents. Like with your kids, you should expect them to maybe have a little bit of upset about this major transition. But once you've done the amelioration stuff, the stuff that helps reduce it, reframing by telling them it's not all bad, etc. Like you won't have me in your face all the time. So that's a good thing, isn't it, Johnny? Do you know what I mean? Once you've done all that sort of stuff, if then for 2 or 3 days after all of that, they're still having disturbed sleep, problems with appetite, general outlook on life has changed, they're either more anxious or more depressed, then that's a good sign that maybe there is something going on that you want to take some extra action on.
Yeah.
And so you use those types of that knowledge and those timescales as a way of understanding when it is actually a problem.
So you eliminate the possibilities and then you're left with the probable, right. I suppose. And another thing, a piece of advice from you, which I think is really useful, is, and as I say, you know, I don't know if we're a new generation. It doesn't feel like, I always thought my parents were really calm and, you know, chilled and relaxed. And I think my children think that I'm mad. Do you know what I mean?
They're probably correct, but, right?
I suspect they are.
Very insightful young adults.
Exactly. But what I'm getting to is how we talk to our children. Because I would come out, you know, is everything okay? What happened at school? Was it okay? You're right. And I'm up to high dome myself. Now, I'm working on me. You know, I'm trying to step out of myself and all this kind of stuff, right? But, you know, I suppose it's really important how we speak to them. Because they're sponges. They're mirrors.
You can amplify it. Do you know what I mean? You really can amplify it by your own anxiety. What you want to do is you want to role model. You want to model the type of behavior and response that you'd like to see in your kids. So think of very basic stuff about nonverbal communication. So think very basic, like, are my muscles tense or relaxed? Is my vocal tone high-pitched and panicked or low-pitched and relaxed? So am I going, don't worry, it's all right? And actually, what you're saying there is it's not all right, aren't you? And the physical, nonverbal stuff that you're doing is communicating. So relax yourself. Go, I think it's going to be all right, but let's talk it through. Let's find out what's going on. And then you go into that soothing voice, relaxed body tone, and your kid will copy you. That's the way it is.
A caller says,
from that.
Yeah, for sure. A caller says, hi, Greg. My teenage son developed nausea in the mornings about a year ago and would throw up before school. He'd be fine once he was in school. He cannot explain it and doesn't understand why he's anxious because he's got no issues at school and gets on well, both academically and with friends. He cannot eat breakfast before school because he throws up. He's no issues at weekends or holidays. He just threw up this morning. He goes back to school tomorrow. What can I do to help? Well, this sounds like, you know, the anticipation of something is worse than
stress hormones. It's really simple.
And my stomach used to get in a knot. And absolutely, I know exactly how this young person feels. The only difference between me and this person is mine didn't stop once I went into school. Mine continued through school as well. So what would your advice be to this parent?
Well, first thing to understand what's going on, it's a stress hormone called cortisol. And its job is, it's called fight-flight mechanism. And cortisol's job is to literally make you throw up so that you can fight better. Because you can't win a battle if your stomach's full of your Sunday lunch. So it makes you throw up. So that's what's going on, is your son's body is preparing himself for battle. Now, once you understand that and understand how that bit of the brain operates, that bit of the brain operates not through language, but by physical things. So you know he's going to feel nauseous in the morning. You know why he's going to feel nauseous in the morning. So you look at things like relaxation techniques, principally, and breathing techniques, and techniques that are going to help him manage, because he will also feel at the same time, and if you talk to him, I'll tell you this, I guarantee, he'll also feel the surge of adrenaline in his body. So his heartbeat will have gone up. I know this because they come together. Adrenaline and cortisol come together. And then you can teach your son. So he'll have the narrowing of vision, the sharpening of his hearing. He'll have sweaty palms, dry mouth, nausea, all those signs that his body's gone into alert. So you do the opposite of alert. You learn relaxation techniques, muscle relaxation. So there's a great relaxation technique where you go, okay, one, two, three, breathe in and hold everything. And now breathe out and let all your muscles go and say the word relax. And so you associate the word relax with that feeling of relaxation. And you do that. There's other things. If he has more general sense of anxiety and this activation of his hormones, a great way of dealing with cortisol in particular, because it gets injected into your muscles, not your bloodstream, is take up things like kickboxing and boxing. So actually do the fight flight activities and wash that out of your system. Mm-hmm. So a bit of boxing in the gym, a bit of running, etc., during the daytime will take all that away.
Is it possible too that if your advice that you've related, if the mum or dad there has that conversation with the son, so they don't see it as a weakness and they understand the biology of what's actually happening, that because of the awareness of it, it might actually help to stem it.
Generally, 90% of times, they'll get rid of the problem.
Because you know what's going on. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it's not a weakness. It's especially
the things that you need to do.
I beg your pardon, though, especially the way you phrase it, like, you know, this is instinctive, this is you're fighting and you're preparing. Like, it comes across more as a strength thing than a weakness. And I think, you know, that would really help maybe in dissipating it.
It's not a problem. It's only a problem when it's inappropriate. So if there was actually a saber-toothed tiger and about to eat you and just you threw up ready to fight it off, great. But there isn't a saber-toothed tiger. It's school, and all you have to do is reframe it. That's the great thing about being a conscious social animal, is our thoughts can affect what we experience.
Yeah.
So when we understand that, and if your son can then understand that and go, oh, it's fine, it's just there isn't a threat, and you can talk yourself down so that you don't have it. But also, I think particularly with cortisol, it is worth noting that it goes into your muscles, so you have to do something with it, right? And so a bit of exercise is a good idea, particularly for young people, because it just sits in your muscles and you need to use it up, really.
Mm. Now, what about, say, for instance, in sixth class in national school? You know, it's just they're often smaller classes, or they can be quite big classes, but a shy child has found their space in there. They've got a small group of friends and, you know, they're shy in nature, but they're still getting on with it. And now they're heading into big school for the first time, bigger classes, people from all different schools, from all different areas, you know, and they're really, I don't want to go in here because they, you know, their shyness or insecurity or whatever it might be. So it's not necessarily connected to anxiety and other things that we talk about, but it just by nature, this seems a very intimidating, scary experience in space. And I am sure there are people listening to the show this morning in that situ. So what? How do you help your child through that and into the big school?
Well, you're talking about skills acquisition here. So that self-knowledge about, like, I'm an introverted or shy person more generally, and there's nothing wrong with that. But also I need the skills of being able to be in groups. I mean, that's the truth of life. And you can learn those skills about being in groups. So one of the skills is managing your own unhelpful reactions, like this spike in these hormones that are about suggesting there's a threat. So you manage all that stuff. And then you learn a new set of skills. You know, you learn skills around projecting your voice so that you convey confidence, for example. So I often say to parents, you know, have you thought about drama classes for your kids who are a bit shy? Because they will learn all sorts of great techniques in those drama classes about how to perform, take on a role, learn a script, project a character, get into role, all of that sort of stuff, which are really, really practical skills. Shakespeare was right. All the world is a stage. And you can learn a lot of really good skills, or singing, any of the creative sort of outlets are really helpful for kids who are more sort of internal, more shy or more reserved. Communication classes, you know, if you think about some of those public speaking classes that exist, they're brilliant as well. But also learning things like assertiveness skills. How do you communicate in an assertive way so that you can get your point across and without embarrassing yourself or without threatening other people? Yeah. But there's a whole bunch of really practical skills. So what I suggest is that you teach your kids these emotional management skills, and then there's practical real-world life skills that they need as well. And it's not about saying that there's something wrong with their personality. It's just saying, well, here's a few things that will help you. You can still be who you are, but here's a few useful skills in social situations.
Yeah, I wonder, is this stuff spoken like we're speaking about it now in sixth class or at certain times in students' lives where all 30 of them or 12 or how many there are sat down and it's explained to them what's chemically be happening when they feel something? Do you know what I mean? Like,
Schools are doing it. Doing this work, but a lot aren't, you know. And I think one of the great things about this approach, and this is particularly with young people, they love this neuroscience because it tells them there's nothing wrong with them.
But you know that guy that gets nauseous in the morning, if that conversation would happen at some point at school, like they'd probably go out into the schoolyard after it and go, wow, that's I feel like that every day. And another one would go,
Absolutely. Me too, actually.
I thought it was me eating too late going to... Do you know what I mean? It would just be great to empower them with the simple stuff just to help, you know, because we talk about the words like anxiety and all the big words, right, and self-harm and all this. And I'm not conflating, right, but... Do we actually talk about really the basics that can affect people on a everyday, day-to-day basis? And it affects all of us at one point or other. I don't care what your outward facade is.
Without a doubt, I agree. And it comes from cognitive behavioral therapy, to be honest, what I'm talking about is. And the basic assumption in CBT is that we are intelligent human beings, and if you give people the appropriate knowledge, they'll do the right thing for themselves, right? So literally teaching people what anxiety feels like as a physical response and how you manage it is often all that needs to happen. Exactly the same way with depression, you know, the avoidance stuff that we do, the lack of motivation, the need to put things in our diary and not do them because of we feel like doing them, understanding that exercise will ameliorate or reduce the effects of depression and isolation and loneliness, etc. So you do it without an expectation that it's going to make you feel great, but you know it's going to stop you feeling worse, etc. So when you teach people this basic stuff, they will do the right thing. And kids in particular love this stuff. I think one of the issues I have, and I'm going to have to be careful and not getting on my soapbox, is that a lot of people come on shows and they talk about this stuff and they really don't know what they're talking about. And so they give a little bit of really unhelpful knowledge, which doesn't really help people manage what's going on. There's no point in knowing that anxiety and depression exists if you don't know what those things actually are for you as an individual and what you can do about them. It's a real problem that we have this sort of general throwaway terms that are used without people sitting and go, well, what does that actually mean?
And I hope I'm not misframing some of the things that you're saying, but I just am of a mind, whereas I like to describe certain things that happen, like anxiety, the nausea and stuff, as you know, it's our brain's our friend, right? And it's trying to protect us. But sometimes it doesn't get it right. Sometimes it's sort of rooted in overly cautious mode. So we have to sort of train it or talk to it or overpower it to say, right, I appreciate that you think I'm going to make a fool of myself walking into school today. But listen, brain, I've got this. You know, trust me. Now, I know that's a kind of simplistic way of putting to it, but I think it's far more positive than sort of talking about this dark, black, negative emotion or feeling that's sweeping through you.
It is an attempt to look after you, and that's what's really important to understand. It's also quite often an inappropriate intervention. The way I think about it is like this. Is it really, you should think about these things as suggestions from your brain. And then you have to think, is that a useful suggestion or not? Okay, so all it's going is this a dangerous situation? When you feel anxious, your brain is going, I think this might be a dangerous situation. What do you think? And you've got then a decision to make. Is it a dangerous situation or not? Often it's not. And you can then work on that and say, thanks for that. But it isn't dangerous.
Your brain, trust me, I've got this.
Right, exactly, exactly right. And the way you do that is you get empowered with appropriate knowledge about what's actually happening for you.
Okay.
Otherwise, what happens is your brain makes this suggestion and you just go, oh, my God, there's something wrong. And there isn't. It's just asking you a question, right? And then you use your critical faculties to figure out whether or not the answer is yes or no.
Yeah. And there's a video, you see the videos of top babies that did an experiment whereby it's one sheet of glass over a solid area and then there's a drop. And early on in their infancy, they'll crawl straight across the solid area and out over the top of the drop effectively. But there comes a point whereby they'll pull back because there's a danger there that's been. I have no idea if that's got anything to do with it, but they're kind of funny, cool videos. But there comes a point where the brain obviously says, right, danger, you know, and that's where it's protecting you.
It is sort of triggers and responses. Yeah.
Okay.
That's what happens is we train our brain into an automated response, and that's generally quite useful if you're boiling an egg because you don't want to be thinking too hard about how to boil an egg. You just want to boil it, right, or driving a car. But if it's situations in which the automated response is inappropriate, you have to retrain yourself.
I was going to wrap up, but if you don't mind, just address this one question because it's probably time sensitive and maybe something might be able to be said that might help. A listener says, my son's 15, simply won't go to school at all. He sleeps all day and refuses to go. What can I do?
I think you need professional help in that situation. It's not something I can sort out in a radio.
Well, can I throw a curveball here and also examine? There was a point, right, I don't want to overshare, but I left school at that age. I couldn't go to school. I didn't want to go to school. I wasn't naughty. I wasn't bold. Yeah, I was nervous and anxious, but that wasn't it. I didn't fit in. I couldn't fit myself into that. There's the social element of it, the learning element of it. I just simply could not have been counselled into going.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting...
But sometimes... I'm not saying you are, sorry, Noel. I'm just offering that as an old... Sometimes some people just can't fit themselves into that.
That's absolutely right. But what I'm suggesting is that in a situation which is quite extreme, like the one you've just suggested, you need somebody to come in and do an assessment to tell you, is it just the personality? Don't worry about it. Try and find some other educational provision. Or is there a problem?
Brilliant. Perfect advice, yeah. So everything is there to say that you need external professional advice to determine what's going on and then take your next step from there.
That's right. It. It's beyond your parenting capacity is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I fully get what you're saying. Noel, thank you so very much indeed. I really do appreciate your time. Mental health expert Noel McDermott. That was Wellness Wednesday and hopefully of some use to you out there. Jerry joins us now. Thanks for taking the call, Jerry. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg.
Right, your situation, Jerry, outline it for us.
Well, my situation basically is, Greg, it's not for me. My wife has a disability, and we had a double yellow box put outside the gates for access for a wheelchair and to get to the car. And that was there first put down about 15 years ago. And, well, like all disabilities, condition progresses. 2 years ago, the council tarred the roads here and covered the box, obviously, with the tar and said it would be replaced in a short time again. So I have been in contact with them. My wife has sent emails to them. I have phoned them. And every time she sent an email, reply was, message will be dealt with in due course. I've got on the council office, which I assume is the department is looking after this, and took the details, they passed on, somebody got back to you, never got back. I phoned there about 2 weeks ago and got through to somebody in the office, told them the story. The position we're in now, my wife is confined to a wheelchair, she's a power wheelchair, and self-propelled wheelchair, you know, that's the manual one that somebody puts you in. And this was all got because her condition has deteriorated over time. So, as I say, between that, sending the emails, nobody got back to us. So, before she could get the power chair, the occupational therapist had a look around with me, and she said, we have a problem here before we can get the power chair. There was a high curb outside the footpath. So she said, that's a danger for a wheelchair user. We need to be, you know, a drop curb, a low curb put in. And in fairness now, she contacted the, I'm saying council, I'm not too sure what the right department is. And in fairness to him, the rep within a couple of weeks, boy come, knocked the door, and he said he was out to look about this drop curb, showed him. And I said to him, look, there's a yellow box to go back there, and it never went back since. And he said, well, I'm only here to look at this, and I'll report, you know, to my boss, whatever. And as I say, here we are now, 2 years later, at least 2 years later, and we kind of get answers. I don't know why.
Okay, so to recap, there was a yellow box placed there. The car, the road was tarred a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
There was promises of the yellow box being restored. That never happened.
Yes.
Then there was a suggestion that we can put double yellow lines there. You said no, because they'll be ignored. We need the box that was already there returned, and now we have this stalemate. You're 2 or 3 years waiting on this, and nothing has been done. So what does this mean now? You, like all of us, but particularly perhaps in your case, you need access, but you may also need emergency access or to be able to exit. Are cars blocking in front of your entrance or parking in front of it? Like, what's your experience been over the last while?
Right, I'll, as I say, I'm not on to offend anybody, but if anybody takes offence from it, they're the people who's causing the problem. So we'll get that out of the way to start off. My wife, as I say, has a power chair now. Her condition, that's the part of the condition, deteriorated over years. So the yellow box is not there now, as I said to you. They dropped the curb, great job. I can take my car around now if I have to, or we can get the wheelchair out, be it the power chair if we want to go out in the summer, no, for a good evening, for a stroll. And we have to get the chair, whether it's the power chair or the self-propelled chair, out through the gates. They dropped the curb, a great job. But unfortunately, some of the motorists think it's a great job for them because they're parking up tight on the footpath up against the gates. So I couldn't even walk out. Now, I'll give you an example there. One night, a few months back, my wife took a high temperature and wasn't feeling well. And I put the call on, you know, for the doctor, and the emergency doctor phoned back later on in the evening, told him the story, told him what I was giving her. He said, carry on doing what you're doing, and if everything's okay in the morning, and if not, between then and time, take her to A&E. That particular night, there were two cars blocking the wheel gate, as I call it, and the double gate on the footpath. And if I had to, I wouldn't have got out. And if the emergency service come, they wouldn't have got in. You know.
Yeah.
To me, you know, what I'm saying, Greg, I'm not saying the yellow box is going to deter them all, but it might.
It has a bit more authority than double yellow lines. Okay, now for those
that are
watching the show on YouTube, we've thrown an image up of it here of the wee gate as you describe it, and there is a silver car. There is a silver car that I think even on foot you would struggle to get out past. There's zero deterrent. You're not looking for a yellow box to stop a lorry parking there, but I think a small yellow box there and at the big gate, it has a level of authority in that it's observed, I'm not saying uniquely, but it is observed more than a sign asking politely or double yellow lines.
Yes, exactly. That's what I think, because I think if you put down double yellow lines, the car is still parked and then side of a double yellow lines, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, on the footpath. That's what I think, Greg. Look, as I say, there has to be a certain play of common sense kicking in here with the general public as well. You know, we're at the situation now. If my wife said to me now, there's a nice morning here now so far, anyways, we'll think I'll go to Letterkenny for a day, you know, to get out of the house. She has to time it to take medication to allow her to be able to get into the chair, the self-propelled chair, obviously not taking the power chair in the car, to do that journey. I have to say, hold on a minute, they'll look out the window to see, is there a car blocking the gates? And if there's a car blocking the gates, I says, can we kind of go no further? You know, people don't understand, somebody with a disability, the effort they put into to get that far.
Yeah. And it's not it's not like really you're looking for a parking space to be given over here, because you're really looking for 4 or 5 feet. You know, cars may park on either side of it. That might not be ideal, but you don't want a massive yellow box. How big was the yellow box previously? Was it the size of a car?
Well, and fairness, a double set of gates, you know, well, it's a double set of gates, yeah, with 10 foot, you know, and then the wheel gate, as I call the wheel gate, beside it. Because, you see, if the wheel gate's obstructed, you can't get out with the self-propelled, the manual wheelchair,
yeah,
either.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
We were out one evening there, not often be out, we'll come back in. And I struggled to get the chair and the gate. You know, the car was blocking the wheel, as I keep talking about the wheel gate, parts of it. You know, that's not rocket science. I mean to say, as a general rule of the road, you don't block an entrance.
Yeah, but you can't rely on the goodwill of you can't rely on the common sense of people, because
I don't think
anyone goes, oh, there's a gate, because it's an urban area, clearly.
No.
There's a gate, I'm going to block it, stuff whoever lives there.
No.
It's just there's nothing
handy.
Really to guide people, you know. There's nothing to guide people. All right, Jerry.
People are doing a great. It's just it's handiness.
Yeah. Well, we've got
the end of the road.
We've got more of your details, and we're going to get onto the council and see what the story is. We might get an update too on that curb that we were talking about out in Ballybuffet, if that would be all right, Caroline, if we could tie those two up, because I want to know what's going on there as well. But for now, best wishes to you and your wife, and hopefully something comes of this conversation, Jerry.
Well, can I just say before I go, Greg, I told the council if I didn't get a response, you know, within a few weeks, I was going on the show to highlight it, so they didn't seem to be bothered about it, obviously. But that's where we're at, and as I say, everything has been through, all the medication, everything else, the wheelchairs, the OTs, everybody done their part to try and keep her mobility, give her a bit of independence. But that box not been there, that's taking it away again.
You're looking for something to be returned that was already there. You're not looking for anything new.
Oh, it's already there.
I
don't understand when it was there, why it wasn't put back. It's there for a reason. When that box was put there, Greg, it was made clear to me, and I had never done it, that is not for me, that is to keep the entrance clear. I park at the back of the house, thank God, I'm able-bodied to be able to go up and down to take a car up the front, but if the gates is blocked, that's the end of our journey. We can't get out the gates.
I think you've been really fair, and you've explained it really well. What electoral area are you in, Jerry? Are you in, is it, what part of the county are you in?
Buncrana,
okay, right. Okay, listen, I'm sure there's people there listening. Something will be done. It has to be done. All right, thank you very much, Jerry. As I say, best wishes to you and the family there. Right, the Federation of Early Childhood Providers are hosting an emergency meeting in the Mount Errigal Hotel on the 5th of September. It's at 7 p.m. in the evening. Why? Well, let's ask Elaine Dunn, Chair of the Federation of Early Childhood Providers. Good morning to Elaine. Why the hosting of this emergency meeting now?
So the reasons we're going around the whole country actually holding these meetings, because we're losing a lot of services. They're closing down and children are losing places and they're being displaced right across the country. And we're watching an awful lot of the rural settings being forced out of business. This all boils down to funding. If you don't have enough funding to keep your business open or keep it viable, then you're in serious trouble. And we're seeing this right across the country. We can't get staff. The funding from government is not enough. And you can just, when you hold these meetings, the tension and anxiety in the rooms of what the future holds for this sector is just unbelievable. And we've had parents in at these meetings as well. And they're saying, like, where are government going with this? Because they're getting it so wrong.
Mm. And why would anyone stay in a business that's loss-making or breaking even? No one would. I mean, these are services, but it's a business at the end of the day as well.
No, absolutely we are businesses. And that's why a lot of people are saying they're staying in it for this year and may only last about 6 months, because they're just trying to get the money together to pay redundancies to staff. And you know, that's the only reason there's a lot of the services are staying in. And this is happening. This is what's been said at all of the meetings. You know, if you don't have enough money to pay the staff redundancies, then you're in trouble, you know, when you close your doors. So we're just seeing an awful lot of struggles on the ground for the providers. They are really struggling at the moment to keep viable. And parents aren't aware of these issues. So we've decided to host all of these meetings around county by county to ask parents to attend the meetings with the providers, to listen to what's going on, to understand that the funding that the government are giving us is just not enough. If a government is going to fund a sector, surely they would have to do their due diligence on each service type. And that has not happened. Mm. And they have no idea of the actual costing to run a business. I mean, at the end of the day, you're in business to make a profit. I mean, profit shouldn't be a dirty word. Mm. And we are being portrayed as greedy.
And Elaine, I presume there has to be government involvement, just so we're clear, but sometimes these things aren't said. Because if it were to operate solely as a standalone business in most cases, it simply would be unaffordable. So you would have people sitting at home unable to go to work, and you'd have businesses with no clients as such because of the costs required to provide those services.
Well, you can actually go out and you know, run your business without signing up to the core funding. The core funding fundamentally seems to be the big issue.
Well, can I ask a question in relation to that?
Parents get the NCA and they get the NCF.
Okay, yes. Why are some choosing to exit the core funding but continuing to stay in business? Because that is also happening as well as shutdowns. What could be so disadvantageous to be receiving core funding that you're better off just dealing directly with parents and funding it that way?
Okay, because a lot of us of the small and medium services were tied in a fee freeze dating back to 2016 or 2017, and the Department of Children have not given us the right to bring our fees up to 2021's rate. So we're unviable if we stay at 2017. Like, if you can tell me one thing that's the same price in 2017 as it is today, I'd love to know what it is, because there isn't anything but childcare.
Yeah, okay. And is it too late to impress on the government to look at this as we approach the announcement of the budget 2024, or is there still a hope that common sense will prevail?
Well, we are hoping common sense will prevail, but the only way that's going to happen is if parents come with us and come out and stand beside us and, you know, come at the government, come at the local councillors, the TDs, and let them know what's going on in their services, you know, for the provider. Link in with your provider in your local area. Mm. They will tell you how bad the funding is. I mean, we're not making this up. We're not travelling around the country, you know, to, you know, cause problems. We're doing this to save our businesses. Mm. You know, if government don't do something this time, you're going to see a mass exodus of more and more services. I mean, we lost in the last kind of 3 weeks, four large services in Cork. Closed down. And these children, there's no places. So there's 254 children being displaced and there's nowhere for them to go. And, you know, that is happening in county by county at the moment. You know what I mean? And that's going to get wide. That's going to spread wide.
Yeah. And Elaine, obviously you want...
That's what we're hearing.
I beg your pardon, Elaine. Obviously you want parents to come with you, guardians to come with you. But do you think businesses, and particularly all businesses actually, I was going to say particularly, but all businesses struggling to recruit need to sort of maybe get behind this as well? Because I know from speaking to people around here that childcare is almost, and I think I've said this to you before, is almost as big a barrier to recruitment as the housing crisis.
Oh, no, absolutely. You know, if we have, so ISMA have come out and put out a statement there in the last week and a half to say that they have a lot of different sectors within their membership, and they are now saying the government need to support us because they can't get the staff to stay in the workforce if we close our doors. You know, so any business, I would welcome anybody at this meeting next week, because we really, everybody needs to stand together. And the more sectors come together, the quicker the government are going to listen to all of our voices.
Okay, well, that meeting open to all with an interest, which effectively is everyone. And funny, there are reports out today on the issue, and that people can't go out. They have to stay at home and look after children. They can't go out to work. Because there's no childcare available to them, affordable. Federation of Early Childhood Providers are holding this meeting. It's in the Mount Errigal Hotel on the 5th of September from 7 p.m. and hopefully well attended, and not just by childcare providers. Elaine, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Take care. Okay, thank you very much for that. Welcome back, everybody. We're coming to the end of Wednesday's 9 till noon show, and we're going to run through some of your calls and comments, which have been coming in over the course of this morning. All greatly appreciated, as you know yourself. Greg, we went to the big school many moons ago and there were no mobiles, so Mammy can call wee Johnny to see if he's okay. We were throwing in at the deep end and school wasn't always a nice place back then. It's no wonder our young people are so sensitive and easily upset. You ask a football coach and he'll tell you that you can't say anything to a teenager these days. Need a bit of tough love and prepare them for the real world, which is not very nice sometimes. It is not very nice. But I'm telling you, obviously, there are greater challenges now. For some, you know, with bullying and cyberbullying and all that kind of stuff and image consciousness. But I think a lot of people listening, they had the same experience, but in different ways. Because if you are of that nature, it can be the way people look at you. It can be people talk behind your back. It can be something said to you in the school ground. Do you know, I don't think I've said myself that I think maybe we monocoddle or wrap our children up in cotton wool too much. I want to say we, I mean I do, right? But I don't think we've created a problem that didn't exist before either. I saw potholes being filled up by hardworking men by spade on the way to Grania Fort. I avoided knocking the tar out of the pothole on the way back from this fantastic ancient site. A question, does this method work? Is it not antiquated? And how long does the tar stay useful? Is it not time DCC invested in getting a mechanised, effective potholing machine? We must be a laughingstock to tourists, never mind the taxpayer who see this useless band-aid solution practised on our potholed roads everywhere. There were calls to have one of these really fancy machines bought by the council, which would be useful. You're avoiding the tar. I probably drive over those potholes because I think they leave a little hump there for us drivers to pack it in. So I feel like I'm kind of working for the council. I drive over these potholes, flatten them down. Should I avoid them? I don't know. I thought I was doing them a favour. So they've taken out the whacker plate or whatever it is they use. I don't know. Should you avoid newly filled potholes or, you know, I almost put a bill in. At least Alan Kelly's jumping up and down on foot of the electoral line fiasco. I'm not familiar with his comments or what he's talking about. In my opinion, it wouldn't help and solve the Mike redress issue if they ran candidates local and general. I'd say the government parties, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and Greens, would welcome such a move and keep them safe for another term. Well, it depends on if votes are split or not. Single candidate issues, and I'm sure it'll be not just that, because there are so many issues. Single candidate issues can be really, really effective and have the balance of power and can get changes made. We don't even know, and I think we should. Do you remember when there was a couple of tight votes that the government only squeezed by on and they were able to enjoy the support of rural independents? There was a wish list. You know, things were delivered to those people. Now, as I say, because it's probably our money and we've talked about bartering accounts, does the government have a barter account to win the support of independent TDs? We should have been privy to what each TD got, if they got anything, for their constituents, obviously not personally, to back the government. So, you know, we have seen in the past, even in this former deputy, Thomas Gilday, and others, get success on single issues. I would say the 100% redress might not just be a single issue, but be that as it may, yes, there is power. As I say, it'd be nice to know what is given for this support. Good morning. I hate complaining, but there's a dog in Ashlaw. Never stops barking day and night. You can't even get a night's sleep. Thank you. Yeah, I think people don't realise how annoying barking dogs can be if you're within earshot of them. Okie dokie. Listen, that's where we have to leave it on the show today. I still have a pile of comments which I didn't get through. We will get through them tomorrow, of course. Thank you to all of you who listen to the show, those of you who choose to watch it, whichever way. It's great to have you on board wherever you're listening or watching. We'll be back tomorrow morning from 9 a.m. So for me, Greg Hughes, and the production team of Caroline Orr, who researched and produced, and Niamh Shields, looking after the social media, etc. Have a wonderful Wednesday. Don't go anywhere, though, because the one and only John Breslin's coming up around the Northwest after the news headlines at 12.